Yes. This slide I'm not gonna talk about, and those of you who have seen me talk before are probably getting sick of seeing it by now. For those of you that haven't heard me talk before, I did really want to show you just this slide. And this is basically saying that what I'm showing here is data from all sequenced bacterial genomes 3 years back, or 4 years back by now. And every dot is a genome, and on the x-axis is the number of genes in that genome, and on the y-axis is, dots are different colors, are the number of genes in different functional categories. So, for instance, the red dots give you the number of transcription regulators in different bacterial genomes as a function of genome size. The green dots, the number of genes involved in the cell cycle. The blue dots, metabolism. And so the only thing, and these axes are shown on log scale, so the only thing that I want to get you, want you to get from this is what it says here at the top of the slide. That the number of genes in different functional categories grows as power laws, size of the genome, really very reproducible across all area, and when I did it also across eukaryotes, although, you know, this, I don't know what to think about this, but there weren't many eukaryotes that I should redo it. And different functional categories have different slopes. And so in particular, what you will see, what you see is that regulatory genes like transcription regulators and signal transducers, they grow much faster than linear with the size of the genome, whereas very simple things like, or essential things like DNA replication, protein biosynthesis, their exponents are very low. Okay? And so, and what this says basically is that when you look at very long evolutionary timescales, the relative rates of duplication and deletion of genes in these different functional categories have limit to fixed ratios. That's what it says. You can, okay, look at this paper. You can, this is all I want to say about it. And I think this is quite interesting because, I mean, these are numbers, right? And these numbers seem to somehow apply to evolution across all bacteria. And so that's something interesting there. Sorry? No, they stay roughly the same. Yes. We don't know. So a number of people have tried to say, well, look, if you go on and on, then you get more transcriptory factors than you have genes, and that's impossible. Right? So it sets an upper bound on genome size. And so several people, and okay, so nobody has found bacteria with really more than 10,000 genes, as far as I'm aware of. And it's sort of believed that that's an upper bound. Well, this here's eukaryotes. The slopes are not the same. But people have tried to come up with ways of actually getting the number 10,000 out of these. Doesn't really work, as far as I can tell. Okay. Yeah. No, these are like the, these are mycoplasmas and so on, right? I mean, actually here, I should really redo this, right? But when I did this, there was like a human mouse, Arabidopsis, C. elegans, fly, two yeasts, Plasmodium, and Giardia theta, which is some crazy nuclear morph that lives inside another cell. And it's really, it's almost embarrassing that the line goes just through them. Right? I mean, it shouldn't come out, because these things are so different, right? It shouldn't really work. And also, you know, there is like splice variation and so on. I'm just very dumbly counting genes from the database, right? Yeah. Here. Yeah. Well, I mean, I sort of, the most dramatic is here, right? So these bacteria, they have on the order of a handful of transcription factors. These bacteria, they have about 1,000 transcription factors. So here, it's about, you know, 11, 12% of the genome. Here, it's 1%. So the fraction grows by one order of magnitude. That's sort of the range. Okay. here I don't think it's very big. The uncertainty on this axis, I guess, is a bit bigger. It's sort of, you know, at some point it also depends on what do you call a transcription factor. And it's not so much that we don't know what these genes are roughly doing, but more that the classification scheme breaks down. That you say, okay, so do you want to count general transcription factors or only ones that are sequence specific? Do you want to count co-activators or only the ones that bind DNA and so on and so on, right? And then it becomes, yes. Not that I know of, but that's a very good question. Might well be, actually, yes. Yeah, okay, so, but I promised to talk about motif finding, but I can tell you that, yeah, this is why I'm showing you. I just want to whet your appetite, right? That's what Yeah. Okay, so this graph I really... Okay, so here... Okay, so this plot, I mean, I really don't want to claim anything about. Because I don't think, based on the number of data points and so on, I can really say much. Just for the reason you're saying that the range here is also not so big. It's just that whenever I showed this, people were asking, what about eukaryotes? And so, you know, I made the plot. But I think here it is really meaningful. And I think, really, I mean, power laws, there's nothing very, very special about power laws. Physicists have a little bit of a problem that because they've learned about power laws in critical phenomena, now they think there's something really critical going on. But this is not necessarily true. In fact, any time where you have sort of multiplicative processes, it's very easy to get power law behavior because sort of the natural scale is the log scale. And so all I'm saying is that is sort of borne out here, that the natural scale to compare numbers here is logs of numbers. Because these genes, they multiply, right? They don't add. That, I mean, very roughly speaking. Yes?
I just think, like, if we're going to use this sound on genome,
yeah.
The question is, why is there not a limit? Like, why would the number of genes involved in personal regulation have to start becoming the dominant set of genes?
Yeah, I don't know, obviously. But, I mean, I don't think anybody knows. So that you can make all kinds of sort of arguments, right? So you could say, well, you know, the number of pairs of genes grows quadratically with the size of the genome. So maybe the transcription factors have to do something with, you know, controlling interactions between genes, and therefore it grows with the number of pairs. I actually don't believe that, because if you look at what they actually do, that's not what they do, right? So they respond to cyclic AMP, and then they turn on genes, or they're not, you know, involved in pair interaction. The other thing you could say is, well, the change in the number of regulators per gene that you add is proportional to the number of genes that you already have, right? Because number of regulators is gene squared, DRDG goes like G. And so maybe there's some reason that every time you add a gene, there is a probability that it will be a regulator grows linearly with the size of the genome. So you can make arguments like that. I'm also not really convinced of that. So the argument that I've made up, that I'm also not convinced of, but this is the only one that I could sort of think of that had some appeal to me, is that, so you can show that you get these things when the rates of duplications of and deletions of transcription factors divided by the average rate of duplication and deletion of other genes is 2. If you get that, then you'll get a quadratic scaling. And so then you have to explain why would transcription factors both duplicate and delete twice as often as other genes. And so my explanation for that is that factor of 2 is because I'll get to you in a second. The factor of 2 is because they're switches. right? They respond to a signal, and either when the signal comes on, they turn a number of things on, or when the signal goes off, they turn a number of things on. So in essence, the same transcription factor you can add to a regulatory network in two ways. You can, in response to the signal, switch some your targets on or switch them off. And similarly, when you remove a transcription factor, you can now make its target's genes, it's like becoming insensitive to a signal, right? And you can now make your target genes either constitutively on, independent of the signal, or constitutively off, independent of the signal. So what I would like to believe is that transcription factors you can add in two ways and remove in two ways from your organization, whereas an enzyme you can just add or remove in one way. And because there is this factor of two in the number of ways that you could add it to your organization, it happens twice as often on average. But as I say, I'm not really convinced myself that that's really how it works, but that's the best I've been able to come up with so far.
There. I think there must be a real functional equation for this process that can be considered as a replication to it. After all, transcription factor typically regulates a particular subset of gene regulons, right? And what this observation means is that the regulons tend to overlap more in more complicated, in more complex bacteria than they do in less complex bacteria. In other words, there could be some model. Bacteria grow by agents recruiting some modules of genes useful for responding to particular environmental conditions. And if those modules tend to overlap more in larger genomes, then we have a mechanism for this bacteria.
Okay. Yeah, I don't precisely see why you would get 2 instead of 1.8 or something,
yeah,
but I mean...
Okay.
Okay, so maybe I should go to motif finding. Okay. So the organizers asked me to give sort of like a tutorial about methods for finding regulatory sites, inferring regulatory motifs, regulatory modules, this sort of stuff. So what I will try to show you is that these various methods that people have used for doing this are really, you can think of them in a sort of an integrated probabilistic framework. And there's a way that you can write down the sort of Bayesian formalism so that all these different methods are sort of natural facets of this general method. And so in the beginning I will discuss very, very sort of basic things, and then as we progress I will tell you some of the methods that we have worked on ourselves, and hopefully I have some time at the end to tell you about some interesting properties of genome-wide site annotations that we've made in yeast. Okay. So I'm a little bit scared about the next two slides because it's a bit controversial. So in all the methods that I'm going to be describing today, we'll be using weight matrix representation of transcription factors. And as you've seen in the talks of Curtis and Villa in particular, there is some question to what extent this representation really applies when you look in detail to the evolution of binding sites. And I think this is a very, very valid question. But so I just, because I use weight matrices and all these methods have been using weight matrices, I'll just like to give you an overview of what I think sort of the basic assumptions are that go in to using this representation. So the first assumption that you made is, okay, so you have some transcription factor, and this transcription factor binds specifically to a piece of DNA, and so let's call that sequence S. And now the first thing that people assume is that the binding energy of the factor to the sequence S can be written as a sum of independent contributions from each of the bases in S. And so there's some function EI for each position I that for every base SI gives you some energy. Okay, so here, and I think some have already discussed this before me too. The question is this a good approximation? And the data so far seems to generate, whenever people have done sort of experiments, is that this is a reasonably good approximation. There are some cases, for instance, Marco mentioned this study by Roulette et al., where they really got a very, very large number of SELEC sequences and they very carefully looked at correlations and you find some correlations. Okay, so it's not, there are neighboring base correlations that you see that are not zero. But the ones that I've seen in the literature, they tend to be small and they tend to be strongest for bases that had already a low binding energy anyway. So the kind of bases that you tend to not see in really functional binding sites that are sort of at the low energy end. Okay, so now, so we're gonna assume this. Then the second thing is that the probability for the transcription factor to be bound as this site S as a function of its concentration C is roughly given by this Fermi function. And the reason I say roughly is because typically this binding site is embedded in a longer sequence. And there might be different ways that the transcription factor could bind to this region in overlapping ways, so you can't really write it down like this, but this is a good approximation. So basically what happens is you have this S-shaped function, right? When the concentration is low, it's not bound as it goes up. At some point, at some critical concentration, it starts getting bound, and then at higher concentration, it levels off. It's just always bound. So now, how do you get from this to this weight matrix representation? Now, I think basically what people do is they assume that the only thing that is constraining binding sites is that they should have some sort of characteristic energy. So the idea is that in the cell, transcription factors go from a sort of an off state where the concentration is low to an on state where concentration is high, and all you really care about is that the sites are not bound when the concentration is low, and they are bound when the concentration is high. Now, so this is again a very clear assumption, right? Because as we've seen, for instance, with these gradients, you may assume that actually different binding sites want to respond to different concentrations, right? And so that you cannot really say there's one characteristic energy for all binding sites, but there is really, maybe there's a lot of information in what the different energies are of the binding site. So, but if you make this weight matrix assumption, you typically sort of, you ignore that, you assume there's just one characteristic energy of binding sites. Okay, so then what you do is you say there's some characteristic energy E of binding sites, and then you use maximum entropy to get the probability that any particular binding site will have sequence S. So that you write as E to the power of some Lagrange multiplier lambda times the energy, divided here by the sum. And the nice thing here is that this particular representation, it factorizes. So you can write it as the product over all positions in the binding site. And then for each position, there is this E to the lambda, whatever the energy is, EI of base SI, divided by the sum of E to the lambda, the energy of all possible bases. Okay, and this Lagrange multiplier is chosen such that the average energy in this distribution is E, right? So this is the standard way that you do statistical mechanics, right? Okay, so. Right? The sum is just the product of sums, right, over each position. And E to the lambda ES is E to the lambda E1 S1 times E to the lambda E2 S2, right? And so you can take them up. Yeah. Okay, we'll get to that. Right now, so let me just show the next slide because I think I get to the answer of this question. Yes.
I think we're all comparing
Yes. Yes, I agree completely, yes. Well, no, we do not know that. You believe that, but we do. I don't think that is really clear what the relationship is between binding energy and fitness. No, but no. So I agree, right? I mean, again, and I agree. So it's not clear that you can say that the right constraint is to say a typical average energy. It's not clear at all that maybe the right constraint is a typical probability of bounding at some given concentration. Maybe that's the right constraint. Maybe, as in this fly, you really cannot put a common constraint on all sides. And it is some have to respond at some concentration, and others have to respond at another concentration, right? So I agree with you completely. I mean, I think the jury is out on how you rightly do this, right? And it may turn out to be very complicated, and depending on what kind of factor you're looking at and what its role is in the organism and so on, it might be very complicated. All I'm saying is I am going to use the weight matrix representation. I think it's a useful approximation, and I think this is basically the assumption that you make to go from the physics to that representation for size. That I mean, I'm not saying that I think that this really applies always.
I agree with you for what you're saying as well. As long as you're aware that it's an approximation.
Yes.
So I think this will sound a little different, but I think it's an important point that the selection can't act on the average energy because each site has a certain energy and so selection acts on that. So,
No.
So, I just wanted to clarify that. What you're saying is that there is an approximation to the average.
Okay, so there is a general. Okay, so let me. Okay, yeah. So there is, and I don't have time to talk about this either, but in statistical mechanics, right, you were taught statistical mechanics probably too, and they teach you that you have to maximize the entropy of your ensemble with respect to some constraints. And the constraints that they typically give you are like energy and so on, right? And probably when you were taught that, somebody was standing there waving his hands of why you would have to do that, right? And then maybe they say, well, because you know systems in equilibrium maximize their entropy, and, all right? But in fact, there is, I think, a much more compelling theory of why you do that, and is to say that this is not some rule of physics that only applies to systems in thermodynamic equilibrium. This is a general principle of probability theory that if you want to represent a probability distribution given only a certain constraint, what you should do is take the probability distribution has maximum entropy and that satisfies this constraint, because if you would take any other probability distribution, you would in fact assume more information than you actually have. Okay, and so that's precisely the principle that we're applying here. We're saying we believe that what constrains the energy is a given average, what constrains the binding size is a given average energy. And under that assumption, this would be the distribution over size that you would get.
So, okay, this is a basic assumption.
Yes, I agree. Yes. Yeah, well, okay, but yeah, let's go. I mean, I think we all sort of agree on what the assumptions are and what the sort of qualifiers are and so on, right? So here this is basically to say when it factorizes, you can write it as this product of the probability that a binding site will have base Si at position I, and then typically people write this as a weight matrix, so where the components Wi alpha are the probabilities that a binding site will have letter alpha at position I. Okay, so and here's the key sort of thing that is going to go into this probabilistic method, which is to say, if I give you a weight matrix that represents the binding specificity of a given transcription factor, the probability that a binding site for this weight matrix will have distance S is the product of positions I is 1 to L, and then at each position I, the weight matrix entry Wi for the base Si that sequence S had at position I. Okay, so that's, we're just, this is basically our starting point, that every transcription factor can be represented by such a matrix, and that the binding sites for this factor will have these probabilities to have these sequences. Okay. Right. Yes. Yes. Precisely. So, and it's important to know this is not the probability that this sequence S is a binding site. Right? This is something completely different. This is the probability that if it is a binding site, then it will have sequence S. Okay. So, what I'm going to talk to you about today is basically a general Bayesian framework to starting from this assumption, find regulatory sites on the various kinds of hypotheses and so on. And so I want to make a one slide sidebar on general Bayesian inference approach. So Kurt has already mentioned high energy physicists and astronomers nowadays routinely use this kind of methodology to interpret their data. But it's not just high energy physicists and astronomers that do it. So I think this is really true, actually, that I really learned a lot from reading this guy's work. So this is E.T. James. He's a physicist. And basically, he's the one that in the 50s proposed that basically the rules of statistical mechanics are really rules of probability theory and not specific to physics. And so he wrote, I think, this marvelous book. He didn't finish it, actually. He died, and a student actually sort of finished it off, and it was on the web for like more than a decade, and now Cambridge University Press published it as a book. I think you can still find it on the web if you really want. And basically what it shows is that if you start with logic and you ask, how can I extend logic to statements that are not just true or false, but that have different degrees of plausibility, with true and false being the limits on degrees of plausibility? And you ask, how can I make a consistent calculus of that? The answer is unique. There's basically only one way of doing it, and it's basically what we know as Bayesian probability theory. And he really shows how completely general that is, and how, you know, statistical inference, statistical learning, all these things are just different facets of this general theory of probability as an extension of logic. So for our purposes, basically the way that this works is you're given a data set D, And first you start by enumerating all possible hypotheses that could have accounted for the data. So you have to define a sort of a universe of possible hypotheses that can explain your data. And then you want to assign prior probabilities to each of these hypotheses. You have to say how a priori likely you find these different hypotheses. Then you have to define a likelihood model that says for each hypothesis, how likely is this hypothesis to generate data D? And then finally, you can calculate the probability that it was indeed hypothesis H that caused data D by Bayes' theorem, which basically, this is just a general rule of probability theory. The probability of the hypothesis given the data is the prior probability of the hypothesis times the probability of the data given the hypothesis divided by the sum over all hypotheses of the same expression. Okay. Okay.
So, to what extent does this also depend on the truth of how you think of prior for the hypothesis? And what is the reasonable prior?
Yeah, okay. So that's another enormous. But okay. So I think the thing that this guy pointed out is that there was all this stuff about priors, they're subjective, and the changer is a problem, right? But what he pointed out is what your prior should do is should quantify the information that you have at the start of your problem. So if you have no information to distinguish the different hypotheses from each other. For instance, if there's a symmetry that allows you to map your hypotheses to each other and that don't change your state of information, then your prior should be invariant under those symmetry transformations. And often that uniquely then determines a prior. In other cases, you can say, I'm going to, for instance, like we just use this maximum entropy. We say, I know nothing about the distribution other than that it has to have a certain average energy. And then again, there is a way to say how you represent that piece of information. And you can use that as a prior. But this is really work in progress. There are many, many cases where you have information and you don't precisely know how to really quantify that into a prior. And this is like an active field of research, but there are many cases where it's quite simple. And okay, good. Okay, so now we're going to apply this to the sort of the simplest problem that you can think of, and that is we're giving a long sequence S of length L, and we know that inside it is a single binding site, just one, for the transcription factor represented by the weight matrix W. And the task is, where is this site? Okay? Yeah. Yes. 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 Okay. So now, in this case, the set of hypotheses is basically all possible positions where the site can occur, starting at zero up to L minus the length of the site, right? Little L is the length of the site. And in this particular case, if I don't give any other information, there's no reason to like any site better than any position better than any other, right? Now you may say, okay, but you're ignoring some information that you might have and that might bias you to where you think you think like. That's fine. And you can put that in if you want. I'm all saying, if you don't have that information, then the prior that you get is simply a uniform prior. Okay? Now the likelihood. So the likelihood, that is, how likely is the whole sequence, right? Because that's the data we have, under one of these hypotheses, which puts this site at a particular position in the sequence. Right? Well, that's simply, it's a combination of how likely it is to observe this left piece here under some background model. So, okay, so some notation. When I write S with this sort of sub box here, what it means is the segment in the sequence S that starts after position 0 and runs and is of length I. And I chose this convention because then there's the least amount of plus ones and minus ones in the formula. So this is really the segment from 1 to I. And this is the segment from I plus 1 to I plus L, and so on. Okay? So this is the probability of this segment under some background model, the probability of this segment here under our weight matrix, and the probability of this segment under a background model. That is the likelihood of this sequence under the hypothesis that the site occurs here. Okay? Now, for the site, we've already seen this expression. It's just the product of these weight matrix entries. Now we need still expression for the background on the left and right. And, okay, so again, you can make very complicated background models. And typically people use some Markov chains of some particular order to do this. But here, just for simplicity, I'll assume that every letter in the background has independent probabilities to be A, C, G, or T, that are these parameters B. And so then it's just the product over these background probabilities. And similar for this piece on the right here. Okay, so now the position that the site occurs at position I is given by Bayes' formula. The prior here is uniform, so it cancels out of the numerator and the denominator, and you get an expression like this. Okay, so this is very simple. I mean, you can calculate this score for every position I, and then you get a posterior probability that tells you precisely how likely it is that the site is at these positions, which is the answer to your problem, and then your best guess is wherever this number is maximal, and you get some idea of how uncertain you are about that it's there versus somewhere else. Okay. So now, obviously, we don't typically have the information that there is only one site, and precisely one site in our sequence. Okay? So now we want to generalize this and say, okay, we want to allow multiple binding sites. Right? There's one, there's some arbitrary number of them. And now, so what the state space of hypotheses is no longer just the position, but it's actually all possible configurations of binding sites that you can assign to the sequence. And typically, people assume that these configurations have to be non-overlapping. You cannot put a site and put another site halfway on top of it, because we assume that when the transcription factor bounds, at some place, it stops a second one from binding at an overlapping position. Now, that's again an assumption that I'm not 100% sure is always true, specifically because the DNA has two sites, right? So it might be that one factor is binding here and another factor is binding on the opposite side, on the other groove, right? On the other side. And so I don't really know. But typically, this is the approximation that people make. So now, site configurations, I, so now I is not a position, but it's actually a whole configuration. So it's some sort of list of positions I1 through IN at which different sites occur in this configuration. And so again, notation, this set SI is the set of all binding sites in this configuration I, and the set BI is the set of all background bases in this configuration I. And now the likelihood is simply the product over all positions in the background, the background probabilities of these positions, and then the product over all sites in the set of sites, and for each site, the probability of that, the sequence of that site given the weight matrix. Okay? Now, second, we, of course, now need a prior over these hypotheses. So we have now a more complicated hypothesis space with all possible configurations of binding sites. And typically, a prior that people typically choose is to assume that there is some characteristic density pi of binding sites in the sequence. And for now, we'll just assume pi is known. Okay, so we'll say we know a sort of an expected number of sites in here, or an expected density of sites, and that is pi. And then the probability of a particular configuration I is pi to how many sites there are in this configuration. So n of I is simply how many sites there are in this configuration, 3 in this one, right? So pi to the power ni, 1 minus pi to the how many bases there are in the background, right? Because the base is either you have a site or you have a background base. Okay? So this is a posterior people typically use, prior. And then the posterior is given as before. It's the prior times the likelihood of the data given the prior, divided by the sum over all possible configurations of the same Okay. So now, here is the first not completely trivial part, right? Because here in this denominator, you would have to do a sum of all possible binding site configurations, and it's clear that there are combinatorially many of them, right? Especially if you allow an arbitrary number of sites. But luckily, there is some easy recursion relations to actually perform this sum. So I guess the physicist would call that a partition sum, right? So, and we write here the probability of the data is the sum over all possible configurations, the prior of the configuration, times the probability of the data given the configuration. So the way that you actually do this is you say, let's look at, define this number Fn is the partition sum, that is the sum over all configurations, each weighted by the probability, up to position n in the sequence. So we're only going to go up to position n, and we're going to say we're going to sum all binding site configurations up to n, their probabilities. Now it's easy to see that you can calculate f of n in terms of f at positions preceding it, right? So here, what I'm indicating is I want to calculate the sum of all the probabilities of all binding site configurations for this stretch, and I can write that as the sum of the probabilities of all binding site configurations of this stretch times the probability of putting a background base here plus the sum of all probabilities of all configurations over this stretch times the probability of this sequence stretch here given the weight matrix. That is, you can write this precisely. This is the prior to put a background base, at n and all configurations up to n minus 1 plus all configurations up to n minus l times the prior probability to put a site times the probability of the sequence given the site. Yes? Yes. Right. No problem. Right. It's no problem to do that. Agreed. Okay, so you can also go from the other end, of course, right? So you can write down, this is the partition sum for the segment starting at n and going to the end, and you get a similar... So physicists sometimes call this like a transfer matrix-like technique. Certain computer scientists call it dynamic programming. Statistical learning people call this, forward-backward equations or Feynman-Markov models. It's all the same thing, right? It's all the same recursion relation. Okay, so now the probability, so the partitions of the data, that's the segment all the way up to the end of the sequence, and it's also R of 1, the segment starting from position 1. And now, okay, so now, right, so we now know, because we can do this sum, actually in linear time, we can calculate for any configuration of sites the posterior probability of that particular configuration of sites. But of course, there are combinatorially many of them, so typically what you look at is at some projected statistics, right? So, for instance, you might be interested in how likely is it that there is a site starting at position n, independent of how many other sites there might or might not be at other positions, and I just care about how likely is it that there is a site at this position. Well, then basically what we have to do is we have to define this little set n, which is the set of all configurations that have a binding site occurring at that position. Now, what is the probability of this set of configurations given the data? Well, it's just the sum over the posterior probability of all configurations in this set. And then it's quite easy to see, I hope, that you can write that as the sum of the probabilities of all configurations up to position n times the probability to put a site there times the probability of all configurations from n plus l plus to the end divided by the partition sum of all configurations. Okay? So again, because you calculated these numbers fn and rn in linear time, you can also in linear time calculate all these numbers, right? So you can very efficiently get the precise posterior probability that there is a site at any position. And you can, for instance, also calculate the total expected number of sites that you expect to get into the sequence, which is just the sum of all positions of this probability, okay? So The summary is, given a sequence S, a weight matrix, and a prior density of sites, you can determine in linear time the probability for sites to occur to any position and the expected number of sites. And I think one thing to note is that all this stuff doesn't really yet assume that you have to use a weight matrix representation. So if you wanted to write, like Wille is doing, the probability of a site to be more complicated function of the energy that cares about the whole energy and doesn't factorize, you could still do all these calculations. You could in principle do complete analogy of all these calculations with the biophysic Fermi-Dirac equations, right? And calculate for a given energy matrix and a concentration of the transcription factor, you can calculate precisely the probability for the fraction of the time, in fact, that the factor will be bound at different positions. Right? So I think, we've done this now all in this sort of probability that there is a site, but you can really do the biophysics is complete analogy. Okay, so now, what if you don't know this prior pi, right? So what if you have no idea about this density of sites and you might want to infer it from the data, right? So typically what you would like to do is you realize that, well, so far I've written here for this partition sum the probability of the data, but you should recognize that really depends on this parameter pi, right? Because this parameter pi enters in these calculations, so you write it as this. And now you could say, okay, let's try to calculate the posterior probability of pi given the data. So now again, you want some prior over the possible site densities. And then this is the likelihood of the data given a prior. This is just the partition sum. And then if you divide this by an integral of pi running from 0 to 1, you would get a posterior probability. You would get some inference of what is the likely density of sites in this region. The problem is that, as far as I know, there is no easy way of calculating this integral efficiently, right? Because our dynamic programming trick got these numbers fn, right, by this recursion relation, but this expression fn is a polynomial in pi that has combinatorially many terms in it, and so I can integrate it term by term, but I don't know how to integrate, but I would still get exponentially many terms, right? So that as far as I know, nobody knows how to do. But what you can do, of course, is you can try to find what is the pi that maximizes the likelihood of the data. Right, and the way you do that is let's take the log actually of this partition sum and take the derivative with respect to pi. Okay, so here we go. So you get 1 over the partition sum, sum over all configurations. This is the likelihood of the data given the configuration, and pi of course only enters in the prior, so here's the derivative of pi, derivative of the prior with respect to the prior. With respect to pi, I'm very sorry. That is pi to the in configuration I, 1 minus pi to the number of bases. One time ni comes down, and one times l minus ni times little l comes down. So you get this expression. But now if you look at this expression, this is of course just the posterior probability of configuration I, as we've seen before. And this is how many sites there are in configuration I divided by pi and so on. So in fact, this sum will give you precisely the expected number of sites divided by pi minus the expected number of bases outside of psi divided by 1 minus pi. And I've shown you in the previous slide that these expected number of sites you can calculate very easily in linear time. So I know that at the maximum, pi should be given by this ratio, which is really very intuitive, right? Because this is the expected number of sites divided by the expected number of sites plus the number of bases outside of sites, which is just the expected number of background positions, right? So this is basically a consistency equation. When you're at the optimum, pi is in fact the density that you observe, right? And the way people find this optimum, of course, standard techniques of an optimum in a high dimension people typically do that is through expectation maximization. So you start with some value of pi, then you calculate the expected number of sites with that value of pi, and then you use this equation to update pi, set it to a new value, and then you just iterate that, and that is guaranteed to converge to an optimum. Now, in this case, that optimum is guaranteed to be the global optimum. But in cases where it's a higher dimensional function, it's not guaranteed, and you get to a local optimum. Okay, so now, finding multiple sites for multiple wavelengths, right? So again, all these things can be easily generalized to an arbitrary number of wave matrices. So let's now think we have these wave matrices W, we have a whole set of them, and now our priors are as before, but now we have not just one pi, but we have a vector of pi's for every one of the wave matrices, which is the density of sites for each one of these wave matrices. And for simplicity, actually, of the formulas, it's easiest to consider the background just a one wave matrix that happens to have length 1, and who has the probabilities just the background for frequencies. Okay, and then the recursion relation is simple as before. The partition sum up to n is the sum over all wave matrices, the partition sum up to n minus the length of that wave matrix, times the prior of putting down a site for the wave matrix, times the probability of this segment given the wave matrix. Okay, so it's just previously had two terms, background and wave matrix. Now I have one term for every wave matrix. That's all there is to it. And again, the equations determining the optimum of the prior are given by derivatives with respect to these pi's. Right, so you would say that the derivatives have to be zero, but there's one more constraint because the pi's have to sum up to one, right? Because together they're one, and that's where you get you add with the Lagrangian multiplier term. So the actual equations you get is that the derivatives of the partition sum have to be a constant, and seen before, right? That here the derivative with respect to pi was given in terms of the number of sites divided by pi. This holds quite generally. If you take the derivative of the partition sum with an arbitrary number of wave matrices, it's given precisely by the expected number of sites by this wave matrix divided by the pi for that wave matrix. And so the state equations for the expectation maximization now simply become, okay, you start with your set of, you calculate the expected number of sites for every one of your wave matrices, and you update the pi's to be proportional to the number of sites. And if you iterate that, this is guaranteed to get you to some. Okay, so here I don't quite remember. I think here you can even still show it's global. I think you can show that this is a convex function, but I'm not sure. I thought about it this morning, and I don't quite remember. You don't think so?
No.
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah. So that's a sort of an intuitive way of seeing why it should still be, you should still be fine. It should be a unique global optimum. But I can't prove it for you right here. But I do know that a little bit down, we're also going to take derivatives with respect to the weight matrix component, right? Because that you can also do. And then I know for sure you cannot get a global optimum anymore. Okay. So what have people done with this formalism, right? So, as you've seen in great detail over the last weeks, in higher eukaryotes, you often find that there are sets of transcription factors that come in clusters on the genome that make these regulatory modules, right? So this is a slide from a paper by Davidson, and it just shows you pieces of DNA, these enhancer modules with indicated on them binding sites for the different transcription factors, right? So this is hunchback, this is Krupel, and so on, right? But okay, you've heard a lot about it, so you get this idea. So the idea that certain people had at some point is to find such regulatory modules that follows, right? So you gather a set of transcription factors for which binding sites are known, and Ideally, you also know that they would like to interact together in regulatory modules, right? So you want to get a set of weight matrices for transcription factors where you have some prior information that clusters of such binding sites for these transcription factors may make regulatory modules. And then basically what you want to do is to search genome-wide for relatively short sequence segments, let's say between 2 and 5 of the base pairs, that have a surprisingly high concentration of binding sites for this set of weight matrices. So this is sort of my understanding of the history of this idea. So I think there were a number of people that roughly at the same time were doing it. I mean, people from Mike Eisen's group, Nikolaus, and then later, I mean, Saurabh Singha actually sort of generalized this to working on multiple species alignments and taking correlations between neighboring sites into account. So these are the names of the various pieces of software that do this. Okay, so, and this one, I mean, this one doesn't really use the formalism that I'm just describing. It really is sort of more of a filtering step where you first predict sites independent and then you look for clusters. But these three pieces of software, they all basically use the formalism that I just explained. Right, so where this has been applied is in fly early development. So here are some of these transcription factors that you've heard about: bicoid, caudal, hunchback, knurps, scruple, and so on. And these are sequence logos of the weight matrices of these transcription factors. And so the idea is, right, so you take some segment of the DNA, and then you look at all possible configurations of sites that you can put for this set of weight matrices, and you calculate how likely this segment is under this sum of all possible configurations. Yes? Yeah. So I don't know if that's a resolution issue. Right? Okay, so I really can't say for fly because I haven't really carefully looked at it, so I'll let Nikolaus and Steve answer that. Yeah, okay. I mean, I think what these methods are trying to do here is just to zoom in on the regions of the genome that may have a regulatory module. I mean, they're not pretending to even consider the possibility to predict what that regulatory module will do precisely, right, to predict that. Okay, so Yeah.
One would wish that giants would be a monster, you know, because they're trying to arrange themselves. So some factors to the information that it needs to be very bad. I mean, the giants themselves are now doing better, but then when these publications came out and so forth, so it's just aligning known sites and
Right, but well, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think given the sort of high throughput biology, I'm a bit disappointed that people haven't done, you know, characterizing the binding energies of just all transcription factors. Just go and do it and be done with it. Right? It doesn't sound to me like it's impossible, right? And we're struggling along with these site alignments and so on, you know. Well, I think they often even stop short of finding the real sites, right? Once they have the enhancer, they don't want to go into the nitty-gritty of actually precisely which sites in the enhancer are really responsible for doing it and say, okay, it's this 500 base pair region that does it. That's much harder to do, and so people, but yeah, they don't like to do it. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so I guess we all agree that it would be really nice to have the binding energies of all these transcripts. I look forward to it. Okay, so just to finish up how this worked, right? So you scan your whole genome where, let's say in fly, you may have up to 10, 30 kb upstream of a gene, and you scan with, say, a 500 base pair region because you know that that's roughly the size of an enhancer. And then for each 500 base pair region, you actually do this partition sum for the set of weight matrices that you've done, and you optimize these pies also. And then in the end, you get the probability of this segment under your model with optimal pi, and four for this region. And as you now go along the genome, you get some sort of a profile of scores. And wherever this profile sticks out of some cutoff, this is where you put a prediction of an enhancer. Okay? This is how I understand this to work. Correct me if I'm wrong. So then, for this particular piece of development in this particular organism, for this thing, you can actually make predictions that work. So here's the paper. Nikolaus is on it, Eric Sigia, and Ulrike Gahl is the one who did the experiments, I think, at Rockefeller. So they've run this Nikolaus algorithm AHAP using these nine. Upstream of 29 genes that already, you know, that show pattern expression in this development, right, of the fly. And so you already sort of know that they probably have an enhancer or more. And then you look at predict these enhancer modules, and so they predicted 52. 20 or 22, depending on how you count, I don't precisely remember this, are known. The 16 they didn't test, and 16 they now tested, right? So they made reporter constructs, they took the enhancer out, put it in front of a promoter, and see what pattern you get of the reporter in fly development. And in 13 of the 16 cases, the pattern of expression that you see is the same as the one of the gene that the enhancer came from. So it looks like the enhancer reconstitutes the expression pattern. And then, you know, two, they showed a different pattern, and one, the pattern wasn't reproducible between, you know, repeats of this thing, right? But, I mean, okay, so yes, you've given yourself, you know, a lot of information to push yourself in the right direction. But still, you know, I think it's pretty good that you can, for these genes, find where these enhancers are, right? Okay, so now, yeah, I need to hurry up a bit if I want to get to the interesting part. So now we get to the inverse problem, right? So from all the way now, we have assumed that we know the weight matrix, and we try to find size. But sometimes you want to go the other way, right? This is already being alluded to. So here is, for instance, the set of all known experimental binding sites for an E. coli transcription factor called FLUAR, some fructose metabolism repressor. So the question is, given this set of sites S, what can I know about the weight matrix, right? So the first that we calculate here is how likely is it to obtain this set of sequences S given a certain weight matrix. That's just the product over all sequences in the set, and then the probability of the sequence for each weight matrix. So this expression we already had, right? It was this. So now you take the product over all sequences. Well, it's easy to see that you can write it as actually the product over all positions, and then for each position, the product over all bases, all four bases, the weight matrix component of that base at that position, to the power, the number of times that in this set S, you observe letter alpha at position I. Okay? So now we have the likelihood function of a set of sites given weight matrix. Now we want to go the other way around, right? We want to calculate the posterior of the weight matrix given our set of sites, right? What do we know about the weight matrix given our set of sites? And for that, we need a prior over the space of weight matrices. Okay, so one of the reasons why this is nice is because columns are independent of each other, so we focus on one alignment column and basically, one weight matrix column, and basically the prior of the probability of ACGT is so every possible weight matrix column is a point in this simplex, right? So they're all greater or equal zero and they sum to one. So a weight matrix column is a point in this little pyramid. And so I want to put the prior probability distribution of where are you a priori more likely to be in this weight matrix column. And so typically what people use, so there's another whole field there, right? Because recently it has become clear that if you know something about your transcription factor, you know what kind of DNA binding domain it is. You may know something about the length of the site over which it binds, and you may also know something already about the base preferences. I think maybe is Eric Sidja going to talk next week? Okay, so maybe he'll talk about that because I know postography has been working actually on if you know the structure of your DNA binding domain, you can make informed guesses of the kind of weight matrix that this thing might, and you can use that as a prior. Okay? But in the cases that I want to discuss now, we use very simple priors, which are called the family of the Richlet priors. And the reason people use these is because you can do nice analytical calculations with them. What you say is that there is some parameter gamma, and that the prior is just the product over the basis alpha, the weight matrix entry to the power gamma minus 1. So when you set gamma is 1, this is just a uniform prior over this simplex. Okay? If you set gamma less than 1, then basically there will be more weight towards the edges in the corner of the simplex than in the middle. So if you set gamma less than 1, you're basically saying I'm expecting each column to be biased in a particular direction. I don't expect columns to be, you know, quarter A, quarter C, quarter G, quarter T. I expect some bases to have preferences. And so many people actually use a number that's less than 1, maybe a half or something like this. And the other way around, and this is sort of what you typically don't use, is if you set gamma bigger than 1, then you say, I think it's more likely that my weight matrix column will be in the center of the simplex. Okay? So now, if you use this prior, so the likelihood times the prior is given by this equation. Oops, there should be a plus gamma here. Plus gamma minus 1. I'm very sorry. And the posterior is now given by the ratio of this product of likelihood and prior divided by the marginal probability, right? And this is given in this case by integrating over all possible weight matrices. Right. So for each column, I have to now integrate over the simplex, this expression here. And luckily, it turns out you can do that analytically. That's one of the reasons you choose this Dirichlet prior, and you get this expression. So basically, it's a product, independent product over all positions. And then for each position, it's a product over all letters. The gamma function of the number of times you saw this letter alpha at position I plus gamma, little gamma, divided by the gamma function of little gamma. Okay? So I think this actually is a very sort of central quantity in all these sort of weight matrix inference things, because it gives you the probability that all sequences in this set S come from one underlying weight matrix, irrespective of what this weight matrix is. Right? Because that's what we calculate. We put some prior on the weight matrix, then we calculate, given this weight matrix, how likely is it that you get this set of sequences, big S? And then we've integrated over all possible sequences. So now it's sort of the probability that they all came from one weight matrix, irrespective of what it is. So now you can do all kinds of nice calculations once you have expressions like this, right? So for instance, you can ask, let's say I get a new sequence, little s. How likely is it that this sequence derives from the same matrix as the set of sites? Right, one of the most common questions that you like to ask, right? You have a set of sequences, capital S, that are known binding sites, and now you get a new little s and ask, how likely is it that this is also a binding site? Or how likely is it to get the sequence S given that this was also a binding site? So this is then given by this integral, right? It's the posterior probability of the weight matrix given the set of sequences S, and then the probability of little s given the weight matrix. So now this is very simple. I can write this actually as the probability that all the sequences, that is capital S and little s, came from one weight matrix, divided by the probability that capital S came from the same weight matrix. And then, so you get that in terms of ratios of expressions like this. And if you write it down, it actually is very simple. It's the product over all positions. This is the number of times that the base that little s has at position I occurred in the set big S at position I, plus little gamma, divided by the total number of sequences in the set big S plus 4 gamma. So what you can sort of see, and this is typically what people do, right, is they say, now they take these numbers and they interpret it as a new weight matrix W tilde with these components. Oh, this should have been SI, I'm sorry. With these components, and then you see that now in terms of this weight matrix W tilde, the probability to get a new site, little s, is the exact same expression as we had before when the weight matrix was given. Okay, so this is how people use, how you do this. Yes? Should have. No. Well, you can do this. You can do this independent of the information content in the weight matrix. When you have no counts, this comes out as a quarter, right? Because if this is zero and that's zero, then it says gamma over 4 gamma is 1/4. So then any sequence is equally likely. That's what you get back when you have no counts. Okay, so yeah, so I already said this. So given the set capital S, you can calculate what is the probability if one more sequence comes from the same weight matrix. But you can do all kinds of generalizations for this, right? So you could, for instance, have two sets of sites, S1 and S2. And you could also ask, how likely is it that they came from one common weight matrix versus that they came from two independent ones? And in fact, you can generalize this, right? So this is actually, oops, the expression that you would get. So you get the probability of the whole set of sequences from one matrix versus coming two independently coming from two weight matrices. And this is then given again in ratios of these gamma functions of how many times letters occur in set S1 and how many times they occur in set S2. And so you can really generalize this to arbitrary partitions of your set of sequences into subsets. Yes? Yes. Yeah. I'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll. Okay, so the things that are coming right now might or might not answer that question for you. Okay. And then you can stop me again. There is a chance that it will actually will answer. So one thing. So as I said, this quantity P of S, the probability that the set of sites S comes from a single weight matrix, is sort of the key quantity. And actually, to help you understand what it means, right? So it's given in terms of these gamma functions. Set the little gamma to 1, so that's now a uniform prior over the weight matrix space. You can actually write this thing as First, 1 over this binomial coefficient, n plus 3 choose 3, where n is the number of sequences in big S, and then e to the power minus n times basically the entropy of the weight matrix, the observed weight matrix distribution, right? So now I'm taking here these components. This is the number of times you saw A at position I divided by the total number of sequences. So this is the fraction A, C, G, and T. And so you have the entropy of this distribution. And in fact, you know, under Stirling's approximation, this expression is just E to the minus number of sites times the entropy, right? So it shows you that basically the smaller the entropy of your alignment of sites, the higher the probability that they came from a common weight matrix. But there is this interesting correction factor here. And this correction factor is due to the finite size of your sample. And what it is it says, if I have n sequences, how many ways are there to put n sequences to get counts of the number of A, C, G, and T, right? So the total number of possible counts is you might have n A's and 0 C's, 0 G's, 0 T's. Or you might have n minus 1 A's, 1 C, 0 G's. The number of such vectors is n plus 3 choose 3. So what this thing does, it basically gives a uniform weight to each one of these vectors. And this is just how many ways this vector can be realized by distributing n balls into four boxes. Okay, so that is what I think the meaning of this expression is. Okay, so now we get to Borer's thing, right? So typically, you're not given the precise binding sites, but you're given some longer sequences, and somebody says, there's sites in here. I don't know precisely where, but there are sites in here, right? So, for instance, you may have a set of genes that the biologists have worked out. They all are regulated by this transcription factor, so they're all believed to have binding sites for it, but we don't know precisely where they are. Okay? So, one of the popular approaches to doing it is an algorithm called MEME by Tim Bailey, and I don't know the first name of Elcon, 1994. And basically what they use is they use the expectation maximization approach on the partition sum over this set of sequences. So what we've seen is that if I give you a weight matrix, in linear time, I can do the partition sum over all possible configurations of weight matrices that I can assign to this set of sequences. And now what they're going to say is, let's take the derivative of that partition sum with respect to the weight matrix components and find the maximum. That is, find the weight matrix that maximizes this partition sum of all possible configurations of weight matrices to this thing. So again, what you want to do is you take the log of this partition sum, take the derivative with respect to pi. Oh, sorry. This is just to make you remember what we did before, right? We took the derivative with respect to this prior, and we got the number of sequences divided by pi and so on out. Now we take the derivative with respect to the component of a weight matrix. So let's say we take the derivative with respect to this component. And what you can show is that's simply given by the expected number of sites in this sequence that have a letter alpha at position k divided by the weight matrix component. So it works the same way again, right? So once you've done in linear time, you calculate the probability for a site to occur at every position for your current weight matrix. Now you look how many of those have a letter alpha at position k, and you weigh each one of those with the posterior that site occurs there. That gives you the expected number of sites that have an alpha at position k. And that is, in fact, the derivative of the log partition sum with respect to weight matrix is, in fact, precisely proportional to that. You can do an expectation maximization like this. You start with some random weight matrix. You calculate these numbers. How many sites do I expect with this weight matrix that have alpha at position k? And then you make a new weight matrix by setting the weight matrix entries to these expected numbers divided by the total expected numbers of sites. So it works exactly the same way as with the prior, but now you do it with the weight matrix entry. Okay, so this is just some sort of illustration. You start with a random weight matrix. then you do the partition sum, you have weighted probabilities for sites to occur at different positions. So for each position you can calculate the posterior that site occurs there, and then you make a new weight matrix from the weighted average of these sites, each one weighted by its posterior, and this is iterated until your weight matrix doesn't change anymore. Now that typically only takes you to a local optimum in the weight matrix space. So what people do is they start many, many different times with many different weight matrices. And then in the end they report the best likelihood they ever got. Right? The weight matrix that maximized. So what's very nice about this approach is you do this partition sum over all possible binding site configurations, right? You can do that in linear time. What the problem with this thing is that you really have many, many, many local optima. And especially, if you wanted to do multiple weight matrices at once, I think the sort of experience that I've seen with you, you're dead. It's basically you get stuck on really bad local optima. Yes? Yeah, so that is actually where something exploring, and I do believe that's possible. So if you have pretty good guesses already for each one of your weight matrices, then I think you could go on a very large data set and sort of refine them by doing this expectation matrix. That, I believe, should work, but I can't tell you yet that we've shown that it does work. But I think it should be possible. Yeah, that is a very good question, but it's also, I really don't know the answer to that. I don't even know how I would try to answer that, because I think it really depends on where you are in the weight matrix space and right, so it's not going to be homogeneous across weight matrix space, and certainly not across input sequences. If you have an input sequence which is just all A's, right, then obviously the situation is completely different than if you have one point random input sequences. Yeah, this will give you something. Yeah. No, that, okay. So. Yes. Okay, so thanks a lot for asking that, because that gives me a reason to move to the next thing. Because that's precisely the point, right? So with this approach, you can't really quantify easily what the significance is of one matrix versus another matrix, right? And so the way that people have approached that is instead of saying, let's try to find an optimal weight matrix and do the partition sum over all configurations of sites, it says, let's search through all configurations of sites and do the integral over the weight matrix. Because you can do that analytically too. You cannot do both analytically, unfortunately. But you can do one of the two, right? You can fix your weight matrix and then get the partition sum, or you can fix your binding site configuration, and then as we see, we can easily integrate and say, how likely is it that they all came from one weight matrix? And then you've done, okay. So that's the second approach, right? So this is this Gibbs sampler. So I think Chip Lawrence and Yun Liu, those are sort of the main people that developed this, where now you have this set of sequences, and what you're going to do is you're going to start by putting some random configuration of binding sites in here. And as we've seen, you can calculate the probability for this set of sequences, capital S, that they all came from one common weight matrix, right? And so basically what you now are going to do is you're going to sample this space. You're going to sample the space of all possible binding site configurations. And the fraction of time that you're going to spend at each configuration is proportional to this probability that they all came from one weight matrix. So the way that works in practice is that you remove a site from one of the sequences. So you pick one of the sequences at random, you remove the site that's in there. Okay, so now you have an alignment minus one guy. You take the counts of A, C, and G and T at each column, and then now you scan this whole sequence, and for every position, right, so you calculate the probability that all other sequences, capital S, so that's these four, and little s, which is this current position, come from one weight matrix, divided by that all the ones in capital S come from one weight matrix, which we've seen is given by this expression. And then so you get a profile, right? The probability for each of these possible segments to get this sequence if it were a binding site, and then you sample one in proportion to its probability, and you iterate that. Okay, so, and this really gives you a posterior, right? Because if you do this sampling and you do see that the counts, right, the fractions of A, C's, G's, and T's in the different columns are stable during the sampling, then it basically tells you you're certain that this is the best thing for explaining this data, because you're really sampling over all ways that you could put these binding sites. And if it doesn't, then it means that you're not certain. There are multiple weight matrices that can explain the same sequences. So I think that answers that question to some extent. It's still, I mean, okay. Okay, so how are we actually going to do this? So, because the thing is, So I can forget about these sort of results in yeast, but the evolutionary phylogenetic stuff, I think I should discuss. So do you want to just go on, or what do you want to do? Okay, I'll keep going. Okay, so... Well, anybody is sick of it is free to leave, of course. Okay, so.
Okay, you can do one thing. You take a 500 break, and then you continue on an integral from one to the next one.
Yes. I'm just saying it because there's a reasonably nice breaking point now, right? So the question is, now instead of having a set of genes you know co-regulated, now you have the same gene from a set of species. You believe it's co-regulated, but now, you know, obviously you cannot treat these sequences in the same way because they're phylogenetically closely related, so what do you do, right? So that is now what the next part is about. So now we have multiple alignments of phylogenetically related species. Let's assume we have that. And we now want to find regulatory sites in there. And so the crucial thing that we want to calculate is that if we look at the piece of the alignment, and let's look at one particular column, capital S, in this alignment, we now want to calculate how likely is it that if this sequence block here is part of a binding site, so that all these letters here are orthologous positions in a binding site for something, how likely is it that you'll see this combination of letters, capital S, assuming they're all evolving under some weight matrix W? And so in particular, what is now going to enter this problem besides the weight matrix it's of course the phylogenetic tree that relates the species, because the probability to see different columns depends on how close these are, these species evolutionary. So let's assume that we have such a tree, right? That we know the evolutionary distances between the species. Now what we really want to say is we want to put evolution of this column of bases on this tree and calculate how likely is it that you end up with these letters at the leaves of the tree, given that they're constrained by this weight matrix W. Okay, so again, I want to sort of put some qualifiers here. There are many different ways that you can do that, and as Vila has shown us, is that he's shown us some evidence that you cannot actually write down a model that looks independently at each column. That you should really look at the whole site, and the whole site has some energy, and the fitness acts on the total energy of the site, so that what happens at one position is not decoupled of what happens at another position. However, you can probably also appreciate that it makes your life a lot easier to do calculations if you do assume that what happens at one position is decoupled from what happens at other positions and is just described by the weight matrix at this position. And so this is what we will be doing. And so again, you should think of this as an approximation. And, you know, we'll learn soon how well this actually works. Right? I think it's not crazy to do this approximation. So, okay, so then the second thing I should say is then there's a fairly general model that is written down by Bill Bruno and Aaron Halpern. And what they said is assume that I know the rates at which mutations occur from every base to every other base, the rates at which mutations are introduced. And let's assume that I want to have some particular limiting frequency of the bases ACGT in the limit of long time. Then you can uniquely derive what the evolutionary model is of substitution that gives rise to that. Okay, so this is called the Halpern-Bruno model, and I think it's valid. But again, for the purposes that I needed it for when I started thinking about these things, I needed something that was a simpler mathematical expression in terms of the weight matrix. And so what we did is we made the following assumption. So you start at some base I, and now you evolve it for some evolutionary time t, and it goes to base x, and you're interested in, given the weight matrix, given the time t, given the base that you started with, how likely is it that you end up with base x after time t? This is the quantity you want to calculate. And so you can write down a fairly general differential equation for this. This is like a master equation, where the time derivative of this probability is basically the probability that you went from y to z in time t times the rate at which substitutions occur from z to x, summed over all z, minus the probability that you went from I to x times the rate at which you mutate away from x to another base. Okay? So these are the rate of change of the probability to go from y to x in time t. So now we make two assumptions. And here's the crucial one. The probability to substitute from y to x depends only on where you go to. Okay? So you forget completely where you came from. You say, I don't care where I came from. I only care about how good is the base that I end up with. Somehow that determines the rate of this mutation. So if you make this quite substantial approximation, then you can say in the limit of long time, and the second assumption is in the limit of long time, you want your probability to end up in base X to be just the weight matrix component, right? This is just the consistency requirement because that's the frequency with which you see X. So then the solution is actually quite simple, which is the probability to go from y to x in time t is e to the minus mu t, where mu is the total mutation rate. So this is basically the probability no mutations have taken place, And then y and x have to be the same, right? This is Kronecker delta. Plus, if you had one or more mutation, then the probability that you end up with base x is just the weight matrix component. Yes?
I think I lost the logic here somehow. You assume that the unique weight matrix applies to all those species.
Yes.
Even though they are separated.
Precisely.
By genes, you know, tens of genes up here. In other words, the restriction factors also evolve, so presumably
yes.
The weight matrix each should cause eigenenergy
yes.
to change.
Yes,
but
that's completely ignored.
That
that's completely ignored. Very good. It's an important point to point out. Okay. Yeah, right.
Can you explain why you need this kind of approximation?
Yes.
If you took, for example, the carbon nanomodule model, which is very closely related to the energy
yes.
on a particular column,
yes.
Then you also get value from something probability.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what you're putting in here is the assumption that you sort of reducing in time limits, which is then of a limited amount of time, you need to prove that the rate depends on the failure of law.
Right. So, I mean, okay, so, yeah, because I'm going to have to do integrals over weight matrices. When I do motif finding, remember when you do this Gibbs sampling, and you put the configurations of sites and you ask how likely is this configuration of sites to come from one weight matrix, irrespective of what it is, there is an integral over the weight matrix there. And now I'm going to have to do this integral for expressions that evolve these things on this tree. And then I don't want to have some horrible matrix with the weight matrix equations in with the weight matrix components in logs and everything like that, which you get in the Hopper and Bruno. Because then I'm dead. I can't do anything. Yes? The moment you mutate, yes. Well, we will do that. No, we will do that. We draw the ancestral state from the weight matrix. So basically, I mean, here's the key thing, right? If you think of Q as this is the probability no mutations have taken place. So if no mutations have taken place, then you have to be the same as your ancestor. If any one or more took place, you just draw a new sample from your weight matrix. So it's really the sort of simplest approximation for taking phylogeny into account. You say, if you're close, then probably you're going to be the same as the parent. But if you're not the same, then I just sample a new weight matrix base. That's basically what it does. Yes? Well,
I'm wondering, like Hopper and Bruno,
No, I haven't really bothered to try and come up with a justification along those lines, but maybe I should think about that, yeah. That's a good point. Okay, so now let's assume we start again by assuming we know the weight matrix W. Okay, so what is the probability of this column of bases S at the leaves given the weight matrix and the tree? So the way you would do that, right, is you would say, okay, I've written down for you for any branch from Y to X, we have a simple expression like this. Right, and it's basically this Q Kronecker delta plus 1 minus Q weight matrix component. And so now basically what you do to get the probability of the leaves, you take the product of such expressions for every branch in the tree. So here I've really taken the product, right? So I'm going from X to Y here, then I'm going from X to G here, I'm going from Y to a G there, and so on, right? So you write down an expression that has a product of all these branch transition probabilities along all branches of the tree, and then you have to sum over the state of the bases at the internal nodes, because you don't know what the states of the bases at the internal nodes are. And of course, you could do this for the background too, right? Instead of this weight matrix column, you had some background frequencies. You could do the same calculation and calculate how likely is the set of letters under the background model. Okay, so now the problem is, it looks now we have to do a sum over exponentially many states, because we have to sum over all the states of the internal nodes. And again, already a long time ago, Felsenstein in 81, I think, worked out a recursion relation to do this sum. Okay, so this is the next thing I'll show you. So okay, so here's another sort of cartoon of what I just draw, right? So there is the root of the tree, and then along every branch there are these transition probabilities to go from the root to alpha during time t alpha, to go from the root to gamma over time t gamma, and so on. And so the probability to end up with these observed set of bases at the leaves is the product of these transition probabilities summed over all the states in the internal nodes. The question, yes? You mean the t's have to sum up to r? The t's have to sum up to the same thing along the as you go back to the root. Yes. So there's another whole field. So there are phylogenetic tree models where people say yes, there is a clock, and you have to, these branches have to sum up to the same if you go to the root. There are other that allow, well, they say more evolution occurred in some branches than others, so we don't have to sum up. What are we going? That's a good question, actually. what we're going to do. I won't answer this question, actually. I'm not gonna tell you how we get the q's for a tree. But the problem, the reason I'm confused is because we do everything with these q's instead of t's, and we estimate the q's in some way. But you're asking me now, do I have this constraint when I do the estimate? I think not, but I'm not 100% sure, actually. Yes. Yeah. No. The tree is fixed. I'm not gonna touch the tree. The T's in this, the branch lengths and the topology is completely fixed. I just want to say, given that fixed topology and given a weight matrix, how likely is it that you end up with this set of leaves? T's are given. I could tell you how we get them, but the way Felsenstein did this, right? He said, okay, so let's take some node alpha and define this number here, which says the probability of all the data under this node, assuming that the node itself had base alpha. So assume that this guy here had letter alpha. Now calculate how likely is all the data under here. And then you can see that you can write that as the probability to go from alpha to beta here times the probability of all data below this node, given that you have a beta here, times, you know, the probability alpha to gamma, and then from gamma all data here. So what you see here is you take the product over all children of this node alpha. This is the set of the children of your node n. M, so M are descendants. And then the probability to go from alpha to beta in the descendant and then the probability of all the data below M, assuming it's beta, summed over all possibilities beta, and then the product. Okay? So you can see this is a simple recursion relation. You start at the leaves where these are just delta functions, because the probability of the data at this leaf is 1 if the alpha matches the base at the leaf and 0 otherwise, and then you work your way back up the tree. Okay, so and the other thing that I want to point out to you, because we'll use this, is that you're not forced to use the same evolutionary model in every branch. Right, so I can, for instance, assume that the binding site only exists in these guys and not in these two. And then I can assume to evolve according to the background model in these branches and according to the weight matrix model here. So that you can easily do. In fact, the Halpern-Bruno model, you could do all this equally easily with the Halpern-Bruno model, because once you have these transition probabilities along a branch to go from any base to any other base, you can do the same recursion relation. So, and there is actually an algorithm from Alan Moses, who used to be with Mike Eisen, it's called Monkey, I think, that uses the Halpern-Bruno model exactly in this context. Okay, so, but the point is, and then finally when you get to the root, this is what you, right? At the root you sample what was the base at the root of the tree, and you sample that one from the weight matrix. So once you get to the root, you have the probability of all data below it, given that the root is alpha, times the probability summed over. Yes?
I just asked about those new problems with all the transitions in the driver.
Yes?
So how do you do that? So you have a different way.
No. You switch here. I mean, you could do, yes, again, you could do that arbitrarily complex, right?
Yeah.
But the way we do that is very simple. And we say, wherever there's a site, it percolates to the parent. And wherever there's no site, then that branch just evolves according to B instead of W. That's all we do. Okay, so we've implemented this in an algorithm called Motivo. And so basically, I didn't make it up, but I must tell my postdoc made it up, but I think it's quite cute there. So basically, the point is that if you now have a reference species and you have an alignment of other species with this reference species, a multiple alignment, you can do this sum of configurations, do this partition sum of configurations, as we've done before, on this alignment. And everything works as before, right? So the partition sum up to position n is the partition sum up to n minus 1 times this last column in the alignment under the background model times the prior of the background model, plus the sum over all weight matrices you want to consider, the partition sum of the alignment up to n minus the length of this weight matrix, and then the probability of the entire alignment block, assuming that they're evolving according to the weight matrix, right? And so you get the same partition sum. And so the one trick here that I have to mention is that when we do this evolution here, the calculate the evolution of the block, we have to decide which branches evolve according to the weight matrix and which branches do we want to evolve according to the background model. So what we actually do is we look at the block and we first score all the individual sequences for the weight matrices. Just look at the score of the individual sequences for the weight matrix and for the background. Now, whenever this little sequence S scores better for the weight matrix than for the background, we color it red. Whenever it doesn't, we color it black. And then we use the tree where the branches are red that lead to the red sequences. Okay? And of course, when there's a gap, then it's black per definition, right? Because it has to evolve to the background. So from this, we get a selection pattern, and then we evolve according to the selection pattern. So, yes? Two, yeah. You're asking, have we quantified what sort of distribution of selection trees is we see?
Like individual candidates that you wouldn't be able to extend by one.
I guess I don't understand it. Can you say it again? I didn't understand. Is that a typical tree? No, I think it's typical that it's like missing in one. That happens quite often. But you know, you may already have that you have no autologous sequence for one. Right? I mean, okay. So actually, okay. So this is the algorithm that we use to on alignments for a given set of weight matrices map sites. And I think what I think is nice is because, as you've now seen in the general framework, so for instance, this regulatory module finding uses the exact same kind of partition sum, right? So you could do all this stuff like this now on multiple alignments in the exact same way as before. So this little, this thing actually, I mean, it's very fast. So we can run all intergenic regions of yeast with about, you know, up to 100 different weight matrices at once, do the partition sum for all of it in like, you know, 2 hours on a desktop machine. And then you can actually, you know, you could, for instance, like train the priors, right? Optimize the priors of all weight matrices to learn how common are sites for different factors in the whole genome, and overnight it does that. So I think it's quite efficient in that way. Yes? Okay, yes. You want this black?
Yeah. So this is of course my question. Do you consider this kind of path? How many events do you need?
No. No, okay, so yeah, I agree with you that we could do a lot better on this than we're doing now. But so at some point you have to sample the first site from the weight matrix.
Yeah.
Right? Because otherwise there is a branch here that goes from no weight matrix to having a weight matrix. And I don't think it's right to use the background evolution along that branch. So this is one reason why I don't want to have sites appear. I only want them to disappear. Okay, so now we're getting really into technical details, but I mean, I can discuss with you in detail. Yes.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead of your thought, but have you thought about using a paralogous tube instead of a polygon tube?
No, I haven't.
Because in fact, the biggest problem, as I see it, is that the transition factor also evolves, so what you consider to be a background evolution could be actually evolution, but for the whole transition factor.
Well, okay, so I'm not so worried about that. I think like in these yeast species that we're talking about here, I would be very, I mean, so we've done things like find sites genome-wide for a certain factor, and then we make separate alignments from the sites Cerevisiae paradoxus micotane yeast and see if there's any differences that you can see. And the funny thing is you see tiny differences, and the tiny differences are in columns that are don't care, and those differences go into the direction of the different background frequencies of the bases you see in these genomes. So if paradoxes have a little more A than Cerevisiae, then in a don't care column, you see a little more A in the paradoxes sites than in the Cerevisiae sites. But, I mean, I, when you go to large distances, this is obviously, if you go fly to mosquito, I think this is a problem. Something like that. But I think within these kind of, it's not. Okay, so now, so the last methodological thing I wanted to tell you about is discovery of motifs, right? So given a set of sequences, now find the weight matrix instead of, if you have the weight matrix, and doing this on multiple alignments. So basically, as I've already told you before, the standard approach that people use at this meme and Gibbs samplers, you have a set of sequences that you believe are co-regulated, and then you search for these overrepresented motifs in them. Now there is another approach which people call phylogenetic footprinting, is so you look at multiple alignments of autologous genes And then you identify sequence segments that are more conserved than you would expect by chance, and you say, aha, maybe there are sites. So here's sort of the archetypical example of that. This is Kellers et al. 2003. They sequenced these genomes, right? And so this is what they did with it. So they took the orthologous intergenic regions between the genes GAL10 and GAL1, and they made alignment of cluster W with cluster W of these intergenic sequences. That's this. And now all they've done is, whenever there was a column completely conserved, they put a star down. And then they have a rule that says, if you have 6 stars in a row, or at least, you know, 5 plus 2 more within 10, or something like that. I mean, I don't know the precise, but there's some rule that says then we predict the site. And so here are the predictions for this intergenic region. The predictions are all the sort of bars at the bottom. And the boxes are all the known sites from the literature, because this is a well-studied promoter. So they get the Tata box, they get this GAL4 site, and that GAL4 site, and this one. They get this MYC1 site, they don't get this one. They get another site here, which is not known, and another Tata box. So this is from their Nature paper. So if you do this, then it looks actually, you know, really nice. I mean, you say, you just look for the conserved blocks and the story, right? This is where the sites are. So I randomly selected the gene in the yeast genome, one, and I did the same thing. I aligned them across the W. So this gene has 3 sites. ABF1 site doesn't look very good. 2 GCN4 sites that look good. But, you know, there's lots of other stuff here, right? Here. So here, your mileage may vary, right? And of course, I think in this particular case, this works reasonably well, because they chose their cutoffs of, you know, you need completely conserved so many bases to fit sort of the distances of their species. But obviously, if they had 100 sequences, then if they were to demand completely conserved in all, then they would get nothing, right? Because it would always be a base difference, right? So it's clear you want something a little bit more robust technology that can apply to different situations. So most of you have heard about this. So this is an algorithm I developed together with Wulsan Siddharthan and Eric Sigia. So this was like a 3-year undertaking. It started when I was still at Rockefeller and finished when I was in Basel. So basically what you want to do is you want to take as input multiple alignments of orthologous intergenic sequences plus a species tree, right? So you assume I have already the topology and the branch lengths of my tree. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to do Monte Carlo Markov chain to all possible binding site configurations that I can assign to these input sequences. So here's one. Okay, so what has happened here is the following. Whenever there are capitals here, the sequences are assumed aligned. Okay, so we actually use an alignment program that it's called Dialign. I have to warn you for, because the version that you can get gives output that can sometimes be violently wrong, and it's something with the output function. It's not that the program is wrong, but it is for certain things. It puts sites on top of, it puts alignment columns on top of each other that don't belong on top of each other, and we actually wrote a wrapper to fix it. This is one of these things. Eric actually discovered this. He saw this crazy alignment thing. We wrote them, but they don't seem to care too much, I think. So what Dialign does, which we like in this particular case, is that it only aligns things into blocks where there is clear homology, and things that cannot be well aligned, it leaves unaligned. And so here, these little letters are pieces that it left unaligned, and these capitals are places that it aligned. And so now when we put the binding site configuration like this, right, so here there are 2 sites for the red transcription factor, 2 for the blue, and 1 for the yellow transcription factor. So we allow configurations of multiple sites for multiple weight matrices at the same time, multiple factors. then whenever a site falls in an aligned block, it is expanded to all the species that are aligned with each other in this block. So here, this yellow one, the small letters are not aligned in this region. All the capitals are, so this yellow site is expanded to this set of sequences, this red one to this set, and these blue and this red one are just single sequences, right? So you're also allowed to put a site in an unaligned region. You're not saying I'm only going to put sites in regions that align well, that you can put them anywhere. Okay, so now how do we score this? Well, as I showed you, we now want to score the sites in this block, taking into account their phylogeny and their tree, right? So as I said, you have this evolutionary model on the branches that I explained to you, and now I want to calculate the probability to end up with the letters TTG, assuming you evolve according to some weight matrix, right? So what I've told you is I've shown you how you calculate this here, the probability of an alignment column given a weight matrix. So now multiply this by a prior, which again we use some simple Dirichlet prior, and now you integrate it over all possible weight matrices. So this is where it's key that I use this simple model for the evolution, because I get some polynomial in the weight matrix. And in fact, even that is too expensive to calculate the integral, because there's again many terms. And so I don't want to really go into how we technically approximate this, but basically what we're doing is we approximate this integrand. No, we approximate the integral with the monomial. That is to say, we find, I don't know if this is readable at all. So we write this integral as if it was an integral of this form. Right? As if it was an integral over a set of lambda alpha independent sequences. And now we choose these lambdas such that the zeroth moment, that is sort of the value of the integral, plus the first moments of this integral come out right. And you have one more parameter left so that you can sort of fit the average of the second moments of this integral. So the trick we do is at the beginning, we find all place alignment blocks. And we estimate such a set of lambdas, which may be arbitrarily real numbers, for each of these alignment blocks at the start. And then from then on, everything works as if these were just lambda independent sequences. And all the integrals work the same, you just get gamma functions, ratios of gamma functions. And that you can really do fast, and so you can sample this space. So there's basically, when we look at this site on a tree, we once do a renormalization and say, instead of seeing two G's in an A, or whatever it was here, I can't even read it myself, two T's and a G, instead of two T's and a G, this is 1.3 T's and 0.7 G's. And then everything works with these rescaled counts. Yes? Yes. You throw it away, basically.
So I can imagine that defining W with some linear combination of sequences where we assign different sequences differently varying between one and two.
Yes.
So
but it's not. It's different sites end up with different weights depending on, you know, if you get two guys, right, that are closely related but have a different base, then they really count as two independent different occurrences, right, because you really see a C and a G. Whereas if these guys had the same base, then it's really only one point. If they both had a C, it's only 1.2 C's, right? Whereas if they were different, the counts come out different, right? So, I mean, all. No. No. It's really. You look at this thing. You look at the exact expression. So we actually calculate the exact expression for each alignment block. And then we approximate.
At the end of the day, it looks like you have a sum of log W, which is.
Yeah, but this is some nonlinear, complicated nonlinear function of the counts in here.
So let me go ahead and understand that. So alpha is what?
A base. ACGT, yes.
But there's no precision in there. So
yeah.
How long is it different for all positions?
Yeah. This is one column, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this just works as before, right? If two sites are in unaligned positions, they're just scored like independent samples from the weight matrix, and you do the integral. But of course, you also have this situation where these are scored with their lambdas, and these are just scored with independent counts, then they're multiplied together, and then the integral is done. Okay, so in the end, what we actually do is we calculate the same, it's just for sort of like also numerical stability and so on, is that you can calculate the probability of the same sites under the background model, and you take the ratio of these two probabilities, because in the end, when you sample with your Monte Carlo Markov chain, it doesn't matter, right? You basically rescale all the probabilities by the probability of the zero state where you don't put any sites anywhere. And so that's this ratio R of the data given a configuration, and this is basically given by the independent contributions, product of the contribution for the R for the yellow sites, the blue sites, and the red sites. Okay, and then what we do is basically we now use Monte Carlo Markov chain to sample the space of all possible configurations. So there's a set of moves that we now have, and the moves are of the sort you pick up a window and you put it somewhere else, or you pick up a window and you change its color, or you take all the windows of the same color and slide them all coherently to the left or right. Right? So this is another thing, right? So you have to sample the space of all possible configurations, so you have to have some moves in the Monte Carlo Markov chain to do that. And so we have a number of moves, but the main thing is you remove one window and you replace it with a new window for any one of the colors that you have, or a new color. That's one move. Another move is you take your current window and recolor it, so it can go from uncolored to colored. And one move is important, is you coherently shift all the windows of the same color. But because you could have that you've placed windows so that they make a nice combination that looks like a binding site, but you've actually placed them a little bit off to where the real center of the site is, and now you want to have some move that allows you to shift it onto the right positions, whereas if you move single windows, it would be very hard to do, right? You'd have a barrier. Okay? And then what we actually do is we anneal. Right? So we raise the probabilities of these configurations to some power beta, and we slowly increase beta. And so at some point, this freezes into some configuration, which what we hope is the global optimum configuration. And then what we do is actually to assign significance to what we found. Is we take this configuration C star, which you find at the end of annealing, as a reference configuration. Right? So we now sort of keep this in memory where we put windows. And then we set beta back to 1, and we sample again, and we see what fraction of the time, what fraction of the sequences from this reference configuration are maintained during the sampling, and this now allows us to put posterior probabilities that really a site occurs here. Okay. So, yeah. I don't know, actually. I don't know, because I have no reference. Yeah, and now it's all these things we should do when we have. Okay, so I want to give you an idea of how well can you actually do with this, right? So, on yeast. So you've probably all heard of this paper, Harbison et al. So they did chip on chip with 203 yeast DNA binding proteins. So they got all this chip data, genome-wide, they got basically p-values that each intergenic region was bound by each one of these 203 transcription factors. Right? This, you could download this big table of p-values. So then they had internally, okay, they did something, they had six different motif finding algorithms. So they had MEME and various cousins of MEME and the Gibbs sampler and so on. And they ran all six of them on their set of chip-on-chip. So they, every time they took all the regions that were p-value less than 10 to the minus 3, and then they ran these motif-finding algorithms on them. And then they did some sort of democracy of motif-finding algorithms. So if multiple algorithms came up with the same motif, then they said, okay, we believe it. And so then they found motifs for 116 DNA binding proteins. So for roughly half, they believed they could get something. Yes? I don't know. Six bad algorithms are not necessarily better than one, but six good algorithms that do... It also depends. Some of these algorithms do almost exactly the same thing, so you're going to get almost exactly the same answer, so it doesn't really matter that you get 5 or 10 of them, right? You shouldn't really... It's a subtle query, and I'm not really... Right. I agree. But I think it's very hard to quantify how different they are. I mean, okay, so the fun thing is actually that even among these 116, 45 of them... No, sorry. 21 of them... Actually, the motif finding didn't find a motif, right? So there's already half they didn't find anything, and of the other 116, there were 21 further ones where the motif that they report is just the motif that they got from the literature, because the motif finders could not find the known literature motif on the chip-on-chip data, and so they said, whoa, wait a minute, this is wrong. It's known that this is a motif so and so, so they just copied the motif from the literature.
But how do we overcome the problem that the particular factor is combined with other factors, therefore doesn't have DNA directly to the DNA?
Well, they try to run this thing only with transcription factors that bind or are known to bind the DNA directly. But I mean, there are two or three cases in there. There's one case where I'm certain the thing doesn't have a DNA binding domain, and there are two where it's known that it binds DNA but non-specifically. Okay, so there is no motif really. And I think one of them likes to bind sort of like where two double-stranded DNAs cross, and it has something to do with structure and nothing. Okay. So the point that I want to make is that there were 21 cases where, okay. So this is just to tell you, Philo Gibbs, when you use the alignments, you do better than these six algorithms, because in 16 of these 21 cases, if you run, you do find the known literature motif. Okay, but there are five more cases where you don't. So you take, for the life of me, I cannot induce Philo Gibbs to find the known literature motif on the chip-on-chip genes, right? And so we looked at it more carefully. We looked at some other ones too, where the data was a little bit ambiguous. And so I just went through the literature and looked up the target genes according to the literature. And then so here's the number of target genes in the literature for all these factors. Here's the number of targets in their chip-on-chip, and here's the overlap. Okay. So you see, it's everywhere either 0 or 1. Now, of course, these numbers are not very big, but I mean, in some cases, there are 28 literature targets, and you know, they got one. Here they have 11. It doesn't have any of the known. So the overlap is not very good, right? It's actually pretty bad, I would say. Now, of course, we may have focused here in on the indications where the chip was problematic. So here are the five that didn't work, right? And so now, for one of them, you can't do this test because this is Celex. The YAP6 motif is based on Celex. So there are no literature targets, right? There's only a motif. But the other ones, you can run phylogips instead on the set of literature intergenic regions instead of the chip one. And you find it in three out of the four. So this MOT3, still not find the literature motif. But these three cases you do. Okay, so let me show you one more thing. Okay, so we've run phylo. Okay, so yeah, so actually what I wanted to say, we have a little pipeline. So we take the chip-on-chip data and known sites. So we infer weight matrices from known sites and from running phylogips with chip-on-chip. And then we get predicted motifs and we have some hand curation. We do some number of tests and so on to say, what do we believe? Actually, this is 80 now. But then we get a set of weight matrices that we trust. Then we have multiple alignments of the autologous intergenic regions of the five Cerevisiae, five Saccharomyces species. And then we run Motivo on these alignments with these 80 weight matrices. And then we get genome-wide site predictions. You can go, there's a website, you can go and see where all these site predictions are. The intensity here of the color is the posterior probability that you assign to all these sites. And so there are 30,000, 37,000 sites with probability 0.1 or larger, and 12,000 sites with probability 0.5 or larger. Okay, so this I wanted to show you. So how well does this actually do? So we had a collaboration with the group of Michael Primisch at the Biocentrum, and they're very interested in ABF1 of all things. And so they did new chip-on-chip experiments because they thought there were problems with Harbison ones because they tag these things or something, and they thought it interferes with the binding. And they did microarray expression with temperature-sensitive mutant of ABF1 in a number of conditions that they know from the biology of doing something, right? Okay, so now what I'm showing you here is for every intergenic region in yeast, we use our inferred ABF1 weight matrix plus Motivo to give a probability that there is at least one binding site in that intergenic region, and that the log of that of P over 1 minus P is shown here. And here's the probability according to chip-on-chip data that intergenic region is bound. And this is what you get, right? Okay, so the first thing to get from this is it looks pretty bad, right? I mean, it's pretty noisy. It doesn't get and the second thing is you see that this is what Villa also showed, for ABF1, there's a nice separation. Right, there is not many points here in the middle for the computation. The computation has a cloud over here, and it has a low binder cloud there. But that is not really true for the binding data. And you do see that this cloud is lower than that cloud, roughly speaking. Right, so there is some correlation. So what we actually did is we tried to find the two cutoffs, such that the mutual information between what box you fall into is maximized. Right, so you. So the probability to be plus on this side and plus on that side is maximally informative about each other. And this is the amount of mutual information you get if you put them here. Now you can also say, let's take our side probability to do expression data. And you get, here is the probability that the region responds in the temperature-sensitive mutant in at least one condition. So that it may be regulated, then you get these two clouds. And you see that the mutual information is lower by a factor of 3, roughly. And finally, if you take, this is the chip-on-chip binding probability against the microarray expression response, and then you see that the mutual information you get here is about a factor 10 less than the mutual information you get there. Yes? No, okay, so. What you should think of this number is a posterior probability that there is at least one site divided by 1 minus this posterior probability taking the log. So it's the log odds ratio. So very big number means very likely to be having a site. Very negative means very unlikely. Yes?
So if you could label here, you could be pressure of the Q1 greater than the one.
Yeah, this is binding prop, yeah, that is chip.
Title on the figure that they give away.
Oh! Sorry, that's wrong. Expression versus chip on chip. Okay, so I would like to interpret this as saying that the computational predictions are actually more accurate than either one of the high throughput methods of doing this, of course. But okay, so let me show you one more way that you could assess that, right? So there's a database. Michael Zhang collected this already like almost 10 years ago, of known binding sites of the literature in yeast. So, you know, you have to clean this up a bit because it's messy. But after you clean it up, we have 437 known binding sites upstream of 200 different Serovicia genes. Okay, so what we did is the following. For each transcription factor with at least one known site, we used Motifo to determine the probability for each intergenic region that there is at least one site. Right, so it's the same predictions. Each intergenic region, you say, does it have a site for this transcription factor? Now, you could do the same thing with the harvest and chip-on-chip data, right? Because they give a p-value to each intergenic region that it is bound by this factor. So you can basically, for each transcription factor for which there are known sites, you could take these computational predictions and the chip-chip predictions of which intergenic regions have sites. And then we could pair these with the known sites as a reference. And so in particular, what you can calculate is for different cutoffs in these two prediction methods, you can say what fraction of the regions with known sites are predicted to indeed have a site, according to information, the sensitivity, and what fraction of all regions that are predicted at these cutoffs by these two methods actually match literature regions. Okay, so this is what you get. So this is sensitivity and this is specificity on a log scale, because it was easier to look at this on a log scale, right? And so what you see is that basically, I find this quite shocking, actually. I mean, if you look here at sensitivity 50%, you know, there's a factor of 20 difference here, right? So to get the same number of known transcription factor intergenic region interactions, the chip-on-chip has to make 20 times as many predictions as Motivo, at least. So, yes?
How many different conditions does the chip-on-chip?
No, I don't find it surprising. I don't find it surprising, but I have had repeatedly people tell me that I should take the chip-on-chip data as the gold standard to predict, to compare site prediction algorithms with. And I think that that is really, you know, not justifiable, right? Okay, so I think, you know, well, can I show? So people have said, you know, these transcription regulatory networks are scale-free, right? So some, there are hubs, right? Some factors have many, many, many links and other ones don't, right? So that's not what we see. So you could do this under different cutoffs and so on, but basically the number of binding sites that we predict per factor is roughly exponentially distributed. This is a log scale. Okay, so this is number of binding sites in total in the yeast genome that we predict. And here is how many factors are there that have so many or more binding sites. So it's a reverse cumulative distribution of the number of binding sites per factor. So there's one factor, Tata binding protein, that has 2,000 predicted sites. You know, and then the second one has 1,200 and so on, and then 50% of the factors have at least 500 sites, sorry. And this is a log scale, so these are exponential fits.
The log, 500 sites per factor is the log.
Yeah.
Bigger than the top being
Yes. There are many, many sides.
Maybe they're not possible.
Well, but they look absurd. Right. 80 factors. I could give you the list if you want. No, 40 of the 80. Right, or something. Or this is a bit more like three that I looked at. There are 80 dots along each line here. Okay, so this is the other way around. Now you could say, what is the in-degree? For every intergenic region, how many binding sites do you get? And what is the distribution of that? So, again, I mean, this we have much better statistics because we have 5,000 regions, but this looks really straight so this is exponentially distributed. And by the way, it does not correlate with the length of the region and the number of sites, or, you know, almost no correlation. And the number of sites per transcription factor doesn't correlate in any way with the information score of the weight matrix. So, you know, you're not looking at some sort of simple biases for hit rate. Okay. What I find interesting here is that we separately did this for divergently transcribed regions and for regions that are upstream of only one gene. And you get almost precisely twice as many sites in regions that are divergently transcribed, even though they're not typically bigger than regions that are, right? They're not twice as big. So I would like to believe that this indicates that actually binding sites in divergently transcribed regions only regulate one of the two downstream genes, not both of them. Yes? I'm just going to rush because everybody wants to go too. But in yeast, Fred Dietrich has mapped genome-wide transcription start sites of genes, right? Because there's this UTR, you don't know precisely whether. So he has mapped them. And we have just counted how many binding sites do you find as a function of the distance to the start site, transcription start. So my postdoc plot is the other way around. So this is transcription start, this is upstream, and this is upstream of transcription, okay? So, and these dots are raw counts. They are just the sum of the posterior of all sites that are precisely at this distance of transcription start. And I must say, I find it quite amazing that you could fit this distribution very well with this double exponential that has a peak at 97 base pairs upstream of transcription start, right? So I mean, there's like a cusp almost in this thing at 97, and so this is a fit to this function. So this, the characteristic distance here is 180, and here 94. So you can ask, is this because different regions have different length? It's not like that, because if you plot the density, so you now, not the raw count, but how many there are divided by how many regions you have that are at least that long, then you get this thing, you get still a peak here. And now you get a minimum actually at zero. But the fact that actually this looks so nice, simple function, makes me think that this is the relevant distribution, not this one. This is numerology, but Jonas noted that the median of this distribution is precisely one nucleosome wrap away from transcription start. I don't know if this means anything at all, but it's kind of fun that this number pops out. Well, it's, you know, within one of these. This is what I find very interesting, because you can make these profiles. I don't know but those vary a lot, no? Yeah, so Aaron Segal and some other people that are doing this business with where nucleosomes go, they show a picture that looks very much like the inverse of this, right? And I've tried to go and see, can I really say that this picture is the inverse of that picture? And it doesn't really, I mean, that data, when you look at it in detail, it's actually, you know, it's noisy, and I don't precisely know what to make of it. You can make these profiles of density of transcription factor sites for different factors. And what I find quite interesting is that you get very different profiles for different ones. So this is precisely like this plot. So it's the density of sites, but now for different transcription factors. So I don't know if this is readable, but for instance, here it says SPT15. That's Tata binding protein. So Tata binding protein actually has a peak at 78 base pairs upstream of transcription start. And interesting, forkhead has a peak at the exact same position. These are GATA factors. They all bind the GATA-like motif. They have a peak. This is sort of 56, 60 base pairs upstream. These are all helix loop helix. They have a peak about 120 base pairs or so upstream. ABF1 here. Oh, I'm not showing it. Yes, I was supposed not to show that. But ABF1 has precisely the same peak as these guys here, which is like 100 or so, 110 upstream. So I like to believe that this sort of says something about the different ways that these different factors are interacting with the basal machinery to activate the transcription. This, PDR1, PDR3, yeah, it's very interesting, no? No clue. 3-5. Yeah. Okay, I'm sort of done, I think. I mean, so basically what you see is that there's a Tata binding protein occurs 78 base pairs, or has a peak 78 base pairs of transcription start, and then there is an overall peak at 97, which is actually precisely 2 winds of the helix upstream of the Tata peak. But there's like other factors that are even closer to transcription start, and then there are some other things like the helix loop helix ones that like to sit here, right? So, and the whole thing, the median is the, I mean, I think it's at least meaningful that it's the order of magnitude of one nucleosome wide. What, how precisely to interpret that I don't know. So, so I think actually this is what we've started to do now, that you can actually use these profiles to actually further predict which of these sites are actually functional and not. So one of the things we're doing is if you have divergently transcribed genes and there's a site, now we can predict if it's regulating that gene or it's regulating that gene by looking at how does this distance fit the profile that you get. And so, you know, we only have some preliminary data, but it looks to me that it basically works. If you look at the expression data, you can sort of do that. Right? Anyway, thanks for staying so incredibly long.